digest and dissect our very first hip hop studio session. And now we're back to do Too Wild for the World. All the recognition that you've been getting in the last several months, you said you've gotten more press, more publicity than you had ever in your career when you were a breakout artist. What does this moment feel like for you?
It's surreal, bro. Like, for me, it's just like, it's humbling. As humble as a rapper I am, this is humbling to get the recognition that I'm getting now. And this came out in 1998. Like, that's crazy.
I want to highlight one thing. Can y'all hear okay? Now you hear above mics. You're not originally from Memphis.
No, I'm not.
Tell me your background.
I was born in Newport, Rhode Island. But by the age of 5, I had moved here to Memphis. And then we moved to Milwaukee for about 2 years. Then we came back. Then I moved to California. And I came every summer. Came every summer from the age of 7 till I officially moved here when I was 19.
What was the impetus of that arrangement, that moving around?
My mom ended up getting sick. So it caused me and my little brothers to come stay with my grandmother and my grandfather. For me, everybody wanted to stay in San Diego. I didn't have family that I trusted like I trust my grandmother and my grandfather. And my aunties and uncles, I love them to death, but I didn't trust them as much as I trust my grandmother and my grandfather. So my mother asked me, she said, well, you want to stay in Cali or you want to move to Memphis? I'm like, yeah, let's move to Memphis. They get snow. You know what I'm saying? I was like, yeah. Boy, was I ever fooled. No snow. I could have stayed in San Diego with the palm trees, but nah, it is cool. I love it here.
Orange Mound. What does Orange Mound mean to you now, and what was it like for you then?
Orange Mound means everything to me. It's one of the strongest communities that you can be a part of. And I don't take nothing from nothing else in the city. But being one of the first historical Black cities, neighborhoods in the city is probably one of the most beautiful things to me. And they welcome me in with all open arms.
So what are some of the hot spots? Speedy Corner, Club Memphis.
Oh, yeah.
Mount Moriah Baptist. Beulah Baptist, Melrose High School, of course, Mr. Tyler's.
Well, rest in peace, Mr. Tyler, Mr. Diary. Rest in peace. Memphis, Orange Mound is the football stadium. Because for us, if you didn't go to college, Melrose was like TSU to us. Like
Orange Mound University.
Oh, come on now. That's what we say now, Orange Mound University.
Both of our parents, all my aunts and uncles, are all proud graduates as well.
Yes, I am too.
Absolutely.
I come out in 1990, baby. I love it.
So walk me through, you know, again, some of those high spots. I stole your thunder a little bit, but I was doing a roll call of no spoilers for my grandparents.
Like you said, Speedy Corner. The shopping center, like Lamar and Elway Shopping Center used to be jumping. Before they took everything out of it, but it used to be flat. That's where we stayed there, right there between Lamar and Airways Shopping Center and Barton Street, Boston. We would just stay right there. That's where we hung out at all the time. It's a little club right there on the corner where Lee Ball, G, Squid, and all them used to hang out at.
Yeah.
So, and you know, Saratoga, that was the spot. That's where we created all our magic.
Well, I like that roster there. Because I'm going to creep closer to your clique, but Squeaky,
mm-hmm.
Zerg,
yep.
A-Ball,
yep.
MJG,
yep.
Tosky, Criminal Main,
yep.
Thugster,
Yo Lynch, Lil Sticko,
we got that, yeah.
Karen,
yeah.
Let's see, who else? Insane, Killer Murphy, Lil Gro,
Kilo
G, Buckshot.
Yeah.
Mr. Imp, Mr. Nigga, Skull.
I'm missing a bit. Oh, M Child. He wasn't around that early.
No, he wasn't with us. He was with 3-6. He just
I was just talking about the neighborhood.
Oh yeah, he's from the man.
Yeah.
I think that's about it I can think of off the top of my head right now.
So, and OTS was right there.
Yeah. OTS was right there on Park.
Uh-huh. So much talent in that little space.
Oh, yes.
You know, if people don't know the geography of Memphis, everyone in here, I assume, is driven all up and down and in and around Memphis. But, you know, we talk so much with people from out of town because it's easy just to say your cardinal directions: North Memphis, South Memphis, East Memphis. You have to explain to people that West Memphis is in Arkansas.
Yeah, yeah.
So once we get past that stumbling block and that hang up, then we can move on and kind of drill even deeper. But Orange Mound is a safe zone. It's not quite any of those things.
No. Nah.
It's its own thing.
It's definitely its own thing.
So when did you start to recognize that there was hip-hop talent around you in that area?
When I went to Melrose, I actually met Squeaky. Well, let's dial it back. I met everybody because I used to dance. So people don't know, I used to be a gangster walker. I used to juke. I used to pop lock and all of that. That's what took me to doing music myself. And then it just catapulted to all of that.
Well, how do you get your body and your mind to do those things when you've been from Rhode Island, California, in and out? How did you take to this version of hip hop and expression? Because it's distinct. It's not like Wild Style, and it's not like the Pac Jam in New York, and it's nothing like, you know, the electro and then the gangster rap they were doing out west with your Egyptian Lovers and your Arabian Princes and then your NWAs and your Dr. Dre's and your Snoop. I mean, it's completely in its own realm. How did you latch on to that and pardon this expression, but emulate it, although it is of your own, but, you know, to be someone who was sort of in and out of this space to be able to give it back to the people in the way that you have?
Being in all those different places, it teaches you things. You get to see different parts of the city, you get different parts of the neighborhoods, you get different parts of the culture. One thing that I loved about Memphis was it was authentic. Being here, you get to see how gangsta walk and hip hop mesh together. Like, I give you a story. In 1986, I was still living in San Diego. It's a Profile cassette tape came out. It was one of my favorite songs on there was the Showboys Drag Rap.
Mr. Magic's Rap Attack. Was it volume 2 or volume 3?
Volume 2.
Okay.
I love that song so much. So when I moved here, I was like, man, I've been on that. Next thing I know, we in the club, everybody like, I'm like,
Freeba Man.
Exactly. I heard that in 86. I'm like, when I get here, it's brand new. I'm like, am I in the time zone or something? Like, what the? Are you for real? But I've always had that style of music in me. Like, my mother sang, my father sang, my grandmother sang, my grandfather sang. I'm just a big old box of music, to be perfectly honest with you. My father sang on the streets. My grandfather sang with Frankie Beverly in the service. My grandmother sang in the church. My mother sang with Jeffrey Osborne. Like, okay, like, all I knew was music, but didn't know. My sister tells me this, you taking on dad's dream. So I do this and capture all of that from being in different spots. But being here humbled me and showed me, like, starting off gangster walk, and I knew what I wanted, what kind of sound I wanted.
So tapes started to circulate, and you got an opportunity to kind of get in on this movement of artists, a clique, I would say, that was sort of forming. I mean, I think cliques were forming all over the city, some mixed and matched from different areas, different spaces, but there was definitely a defined Orange Mound energy. It got twisted, flipped, cut, sliced, spliced in different directions over time.
Yeah.
But in this particular moment, when you're breaking through, everyone seemed to be on the same page, or at least pretty close to relatively on the same page.
Yeah.
How did you, Zerk, Squeaky, Ball G, and the surrounding cliques or micro cliques sort of find a way to get this thing down on cassette and get it out into the streets?
Sitting at Squeaky's mother's crib, man.
How'd you befriend him?
Huh?
How'd you befriend him? You kind of brushed up against it, but
me and a dude named Daryl Baldwin used to dance all the time, so we was doing the talent shows and all of that stuff. And Daryl Baldwin and Squeaky were best friends. So we go over there, and from there, you know, I'm probably the coolest dude you'll meet. I can get along with anybody and everybody, and we just start hanging out. We just started hanging out, and he was DJing. I started carrying equipment with him, and from there, we just built that barn. But we built our family off of knowing each other, going out, hanging out, Squeaky DJing, we going to clubs, performing off the old mixtape stuff, and just roll from there.
So your first verse is on Zerk's track, right?
First song I ever did, Too Thick.
How'd that come about?
We was in the studio, and he was like, I need you to write a song, write a verse for this. I was like, what is it? And he played it. I was like, oh, yeah, I got that. And from there, I was like, that's when I really found my voice, because at first I used to rap fast like Bone and them. I like, I smoke too much weed. This ain't going to happen. I can't keep rapping this fast. Like, y'all can add that. So, and that's when I was just like, I need a style, and I found it. And it just, from there, I just launched in.
How did it evolve into doing your own solo tape?
I don't know. Honestly, I don't know, man. We was always doing mixtapes, so,
yeah,
you know, everybody was doing what I was like. Hey, like, you gonna do it? I'm like, nah, I'm good with just rapping on everybody else stuff. They're like, no, you got to do your own. I'm like, yeah, whatever. And I was like, nah. Then they was like, nah, you got to do it. So Squeaky started coming with all these tracks. I was like, I like that one. Yeah, that's yours. I was like, what? Yeah, that's yours. I was waiting on you. I was like, what? Huh. So he picked the whole track list, and from there, it went down. So what?
At what point does it make sense, or excuse me, I don't think that is it was necessarily anybody's choice, but we get to a full-fledged commercial product, and Squeaky and what had become Mochetta was going to be distributed on a major level, or at least a mid-major level from Relativity. And, you know, this is almost a time where Squeaky's records, 36 Mafia, and A-Ball and MJG were being distributed all by Relativity. And everybody kind of seemed to be at the same level, to have common ground. You know, Ball and G had put out Coming Out Hard. They had left OTS, and they had gone to Suave House, and they had become legends in the South, underground legends, and also really respected all throughout hip hop. At least, you know, they got a lot of love from New York cats as well.
Yeah.
They show up on Mace's debut. You know, they'd had interest from people outside of the Southern rap gaze. It almost was like, you know, a token favorite. We'll let y'all in. We like y'all.
Yeah.
We cool with y'all, but not everybody can come. You know what I mean?
That's for sure.
Seeing that from your perspective in Orange Mound and seeing, you know, these two people were a part of the original energy that y'all were creating. And now Paul and Juicy are getting the opportunity to put on kind of an all-star group of people from all over town, different areas of town, White Haven, North Memphis, South Memphis. They all are coming together almost like a super group. They've gone from tapes and DJing to, you know, having Triple Six and having a local buzz and having local distribution to having this major, mid-major invest in them. And now y'all's clique is getting that same look. How did all that feel in that moment?
It felt surreal because when Squeak came to us, he's like, man, we got a deal. A deal for what? What we got to do? Like, nah, we got a record deal. He's like, we're going to put your album out first. I'm like, let's go. Like, let's do it. Like, and it was crazy because when you think about it, when we did the On a Mission record, we was at Selecto Hits. Reverend Tibley came down here looking for groups after they found 3-6. They went for 3-6 first. And afterwards, it was like, well, we need another group. Another, well, and at that time, we hadn't even broke the 10,000 mark on selling records yet. But they picked us up and they took a chance on us. And taking that chance, man, we took it and ran with it.
And you were first up.
First to bet.
How do you distinguish? You know, Zerk has Toothpick. Squeaky has the family. And there's Mochetta. I mean, how do y'all make all that the one thing? Because it seems like different universe, but it's all Orange Mound. It's a little confusing.
Well, it shouldn't be that confusing.
And 4-7 Mob too.
But we was all one clique.
You're saying the same thing Squeaky told me. He couldn't explain it to me either.
Listen, all right. Hold on. I'm going to break it down. We was all one clique. But Zerk was always his own entity. Squeaky was his own entity. Krim and the Project Players, they was their own entity. I was the only solo artist out of all of those guys. So we started off as a family, and then you start branching off. Yeah, Zerk branched off first. Then Krim did a solo mixtape, then the Project Players. Then Tomsky, then Squeaky and the family, and Tomsky, the Project Players, Mochetta Mobsters, so on and so forth.
This record isn't particularly sample-based. It feels live.
It was.
You know, how does that evolve and take place in Squeaky's production where, you know, it feels more like a band? And I mean, This is sort of, there's multiple competing ideas and ideologies coming out of Memphis. You know, a lot of people want to think of what we consider funk now, or the elements of horrorcore and the cowbells and all of that. That's very synthesized. That's very, you know, Boss, Dr. Rhythm, 550, 660. And then you have, you know, well, all these different things. You know, there's a more of a trap thing that exists now with the, you know, but this is live. Tila's Peace of Mind feels live. Ball and G's second and third records feel live. How did this this new sort of more player G's, another one who's, I mean, he plays all sorts of stuff. Well, this sort of understated, soulful. I mean, even with Blackout and what he was doing with Play a Fly and all of those things, Gangsta Black, this sort of smoother, more keyboard driven, more bass guitar driven element of hip hop. And do you remember how Squeaky crafted that?
Well, Squeaky's always been the one that has like probably one of the greatest ears in music. But with this record here, only thing that was programmed was the drums. We had live keyboard, we had the live guitar, the bass guitar. So everything, it was his creative mind having him play it, and he just played the drum machine behind everything else.
Do you remember who any of the players were or where they came from?
Yes, we had one guy named Marcus that played, Marcus, I can't think of his last name, but he played the bass. Willie played the keyboards, and Larry played the lead guitar.
Well, none of the mixtapes sound like that. So is this an experiment for y'all? Did y'all know that it was going to hit?
No, we knew that we wanted live music. If you think about it, it really wasn't a lot of live music back then. Wasn't nobody playing the bass and the licks on the guitar and keyboard. Wasn't nobody really doing all of that. Everybody was programming everything through drum machine. So it was just like, we're going to make it live. Because probably my favorite song on that record is Why Now? Because I was asleep when they was playing it. And they woke me up about 3:30 in the morning. But I heard the song for like 2 hours in my head and I thought I was dreaming. So he's like, hey, tap me on the man, wake up. We got to write this song. We got to have this done by 8 o'clock in the morning. Man, do you know it's 3 o'clock in the fucking morning? We got to do it. No, fool. But we had 5 songs to record that morning. So I got up. I wrote the first 2 verses. By the time I got to the studio, I wrote the 3rd verse. Everything was history.
Y'all had a label waiting on a deadline, too.
Yes, sir.
Yeah,
if we didn't turn that record in, if we didn't turn them songs in, that record wouldn't have came out.
My last question before we listen is, where was the studio? Do you remember?
Yes, it was on Perkins in a little house. We got some money and we bought a house and
said, yeah, I had a budget.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a nice little chunk of change.
And I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, but
I'm not going to tell you.
Okay. No, I mean, what the house? Tell me more about the house.
Oh, the house was dope. Like, it was, this is me. I don't like main streets. I hate main streets because it's hard to get into your house and get out of your house. But it was right there off of Perkins and Bidronics.
Are we ready to jump into the first side of the record?
Yeah.
Before we jump back to 1998 when this was released, let's stay in the present right now, because this record here has risen to the top of records that people covet when they talk about Memphis and hip hop. And I think that a large part of it is because your lyricism, your witticism, your camaraderie with the rest of the Orange Round brothers on the record, but also kind of where we left off, that the production is so thoughtful and so big, the way that it is arranged, the way that it's handled. It doesn't just it doesn't just sort of shake out in sort of the landscape of albums that you could just easily identify and say, oh, Memphis. You know, it doesn't scare you like, you know, Lord Infamous might when you listen to His Underground or Koopsta, who I think, you know, put together a project. You know, Lord Infamous, unfortunately, didn't get to do in that era a full project. But, you know, you look at someone like Koopsta, who I think has as good of a solo statement in The Devil's Playground, sonically from beginning to end. It puts you right in that spooky place, and it stays there. And I think it's inventive. I think that when you listen to someone like a Young Thug, you say, oh, you know, here's someone, Koopsta Nika being someone who could freak and twist and bend their style in so many different ways. And it almost like part talent and part ingenuity and part insanity. And anybody who knew Koopsta, I didn't, but anybody who knew Koopsta probably could tell you that there was a lot of darkness in his life that probably came out in that music, but pushed him to be who he was. And when you look at someone like a Playa G, who I think also as well is just a unique statement, someone who was committed to making song and song craft in a way that nobody else was in Memphis. And now he teaches keyboards, and now he tours with bands all over the world, and is what someone might consider a proper musician, although he started in Memphis rap. How does it feel to know that your album sits in some ways above a lot of records that people consider essential when you look at Memphis rap? It's a unique statement to its own.
It's an honor because of. I hear a lot of people say, man, like, they tell me how much this record has helped them through so many situations. I had a brother tell me, said, man, your record helped me get through prison. He said, if I wouldn't have listened to this record, he said, I probably would have lost my mind in prison. And that's humbling, you know, because I'm trying to figure out what song on here, this album, that has you that comfortable where you're relaxed in prison. Because I talk all kind of craziness on this record. Like, I'm like, but you're like, it helps you get through prison. So I guess it was a mindset thing for him because, like I said, we was all, we had original music. We was playing. They was playing that music. This wasn't no, you sampled the record. And we did all the sampling on the mixtape. It was like, man, now we get to do what we really want to do, give them good music. Like, it was, this rap record was more of a music situation than it was just a album.
Let's talk about label business and talk about record business and being on Relativity, being, I would imagine, prompted to compete in the marketplace. What was that situation like for you? You know, I've heard you tell stories about being on the road. I've heard you, you know, talk about a lack of radio play, which is definitely a game, not at WYXR, because we play what we like to play as much, many times as we like to play it. But,
yeah,
you know, finding a spot in rotation in those days, and I'm sure likely to this moment as well, it required some dollars. It required some relationships to be forged. But, you know, even down to posing for a photograph, and I don't know if this is a pen and pixel creation here.
Yes, it is.
All right, so that cost some money.
It definitely did.
Yeah. So, you know, tell me about having to create a marketing engine around this record before and then getting the feedback after.
Marketing was It was crazy because, to be honest, they didn't know how to market me. I was the one artist that they didn't understand or really truly know how to market. Because like I said, you know, when we did the On a Mission record, we only sold 2,000 records and got that record deal. Now, this is a story that was told to me, so don't hold me to it. The Tom said, no. But like I said, we sold 2,000 records. And as we sold those 2,000 records, we got a record deal. But they was also down here looking for people. So how can you market an artist that you don't know where his market is? You try to piggyback off of 3-6, but I don't do that kind of music that they do. Nothing's wrong with it. It's just I'm not that person. So it was hard for them to really promote me. But once we started getting out there moving around, it got a little more easier. But for the most part, nah, man, them first 2-3 years was hell.
Well, you said leading up to Memphis Rap OGs that it was the most press you had done in all of your career.
Yes.
But you weren't promoting a record. You were promoting a show.
A show.
So what promotion did happen for this record? What went well and what didn't go well?
What went well was the fact that we got the Too Wild for the World song. We really tried to push it. But at that time, you know, music changes every 6 months. If people don't realize, your music selection changes just like your phone cell, your cellular phone selection. Every 6 months, you got a new cell phone. Every 6 months, you got new music. So if you're not aligned with the people that's doing the same thing, I'm not the Drakes and Bun B's and 3-6 Mafia. I'm just me. But I make music for you to get up and party to. I make music for you to think. I make music for you to reminisce on old family. Like my favorite song, one of my favorite songs on this record is First Love. Because that song is dedicated to my mom. I lost my mom when I was 19. So that record, I was 27. I was 7 years in, losing my mom. And it was hard, but I know she had my back. If that makes sense. So it's crazy with this record how much market the press that we did get for, and it was even worse than the ones that we didn't get, because the second single was Why Now, which was a radio song, and we never got any play off of that.
So I know Relativity Press 12 inches.
Yes.
So I'm assuming DJs at least got them, club or radio and or both.
Yeah.
No music video?
Yeah, Too Wild for the World.
Yeah, I have seen that actually. It's pretty hype. It's pretty buck.
That's the video that they paid for.
Right.
Why Now, Forever Hustle came out of my pocket. I shot them myself. I did those myself.
When you say shot them yourself, directed them, I did Larry Clark do them?
No. My homeboy Tony Harris.
Okay. So how did that feel in the moment knowing that you've put out a body of work that you truly believe in, but not seeing that support? How did it feel?
It was okay. You know what I'm saying? Like me being a musician, I know the good, the bad, the ugly of the game. So we pushed as much as we could push. But also, you know, you look at a lot of artists. A lot of artists have put music out every 6 months. We put music out every 2 years because we knew we had good body of work. Like, we really was making good music. But at that time, it wasn't perceived as well as everybody else's music. Because you think about it, attention span on music now is next song, next song, next song, next song, next song. We was making 5-minute songs. Now you get 2-minute songs. You got 1-minute and 30-second songs.
When did you start to notice that things were changing as far as this becoming a collector-focused record? Something that people who maybe didn't understand it or catch it or have the opportunity to appreciate it in the moment start to give it Reverence and Credence, a cult classic.
When I start getting the people from overseas start sampling and making this funk music that they have now, and I was just like, I was listening, I'm like, that sound like me on that song, on that. Like, what is this? My wife was like, hey, man, yeah, man, they doing this funk music. They sampling all the Memphis artists. Oh, really? Now I'm digging in and listening. I'm like, it brought the resurgence of that record. I was like, dude, that's 28 years old. And you're sampling Too Wild for the World. You're sampling vocals from Too Wild for the World. Or even going back farther, like 95, my first mixtape. And they're pulling a song, they're sampling off the songs of those. I'm like, dude, that's mad crazy. But it's humbling because that lets you know that their music has traveled around the world. We're not just here in Memphis, not just here in Georgia, just in the States. It's overseas. And then I'm on Instagram all the time and they tell me, hey, man, I love your music, man. You're Too Wild for the World CD is my favorite. Visions of a Gangster is my favorite song. Animosity is my favorite song. Hey, bro, the name of the song is Visions of a Gangster, please. They changed the name. So now when you look it up, it say Animosity. That ain't the name of the song. But it's cool. I appreciate it.
What was it like during shows in the time that you were promoting this record? Because you got to kind of crisscross with Ball of G again and with 3-6. Not just because y'all were being distributed by the same company, but, you know, just I'm sure people, when they put shows together, they like attracts like.
Well, I wasn't what I am now. Back then, I was nervous. You wouldn't believe, as much as I love to jump around the stage now and take my shirt off and rap and all of that, you wouldn't believe. Back then, I'd be like, okay, when we going to get done? I'm ready to go. You know, it was nerve-wracking for me because I wasn't used to it. But now, it's just like, wow, I have a blast. If you ain't been to a Tom Ski, if you ain't been to a Tom Ski show, trust me, you come, you're going to have fun. I promise you.
Let's break down the visuals of this piece here, because we usually don't get the benefit of such amazing artwork. Liv talked me into putting this in. She said, last time we did this, and it was, she used the term cute. So I said, okay, I think I can get with cute. Awesome. So presented by DJ Squeaky, you don't see that always, on, right. Especially on a record of this magnitude, a commercial product, you know, maybe an underground tape, you might see such a thing. But him literally, you know, breaking this infrastructure, this brick, to sort of debut you. This is a picture you posed for. He's got the visual cue of bling right here.
Yes.
But you've got more of something like a more, I would almost use the term like a utilitarian look. The wallabies, the khakis, kind of a preppy shirt, a simple hat. Nothing about your posture or the way you're being presented to me reads as flashy, although he's got a little bit of bling. And he's also got on a necklace, we can see here. And he's got bling on his ear too. I'm just breaking this down, trying to interpret, was there a story being told here? Because you weren't being marketed in the same way as a No Limit or Cash Money started to take off around this time. Definitely, I would say that 3-6 wasn't a bling situation, but these covers are being designed by the same company in Houston.
Yeah.
So and visual storytelling is what they pride themselves on. So I'm just trying to understand what was communicated to them for this to be the image that they showed. Too Wild for the World. You're standing on top of the world, and this is the galaxy here. Some people might not have as great of a view as I have. I'm just breaking this down. Am I getting everything that's the same, fair, and accurate?
Yes.
Talk to me about, do you remember this photo shoot?
I do. It was crazy. It was fun, man. The one that I like the most is on the inside of the cover. They got a pair of headphones, and they got me sitting on top of the headphones. That, like, that was the coolest shit ever. I was like, dude, I don't know how y'all pulled this off. But it was so dope. But in hindsight, the majority of the whole cover was really Squeaky's idea.
Okay. Can you break that down for me more? Well, you say all Squeaky's idea. I mean, tell, because I just watched them say that artists will come in, or, well, they said that they never, in all the years they made covers, not listen directly to the artist or the company about what the vision would be. They would sketch it right on the spot during a meeting. That the only time they ever sort of tried to get out ahead of what an artist wanted, or they didn't get an opportunity to speak directly to an artist, was when they most recently did the 21 Savage Metro Boomin record that they did. That was during the pandemic or so. So they had, this isn't even, Pen and Pixels, again, based in Houston, and it hasn't even really been fully in commission for quite some time.
Right.
21 Savage and Metro Boomin requested them to do the work, and this was the first time they said that an artist was just like, no, completely not feeling that, and they made them rush and do it over again. So they said that they felt that it was because they did not get to speak directly to Metro at 21. Another thing that I noticed you said, and just painting the picture, because I'm in my early 30s, some of y'all might be younger than me. You said you didn't know how they pulled that off. I mean, I could probably do it in 20 minutes now, but in this day and time, Photoshop was in the form that it was new, and it took a lot to render this many images layer by layer. You know, in the early days, they crashed computers trying to make these covers.
Yes.
So tell me more about that process with Squeaky coming up with this idea.
Well, because for one, we took that long, like you said, in Houston, we took that long drive to Houston, man, and it was just like, that was a whole day of shooting. What I remember the most, and they was like, man, we're going to do the bricks. We'll have your name busting out of it. Squeaky going to be doing this. I'm like, okay. Like, I'm cool. I'm just here to rap. I wasn't worried about the artwork. I was just here to do the album and have fun with it, go do shows and all of that. But for the most part, Squeaky was like, we're going to have you bend it down. I said, hey, look, I can't do that too much longer. You know, my legs ain't that good. I ain't got stripper knees, you know what I'm saying? We can't do that one now. Cause they had us do that, they shoot about six times. I'm like, hey, they like keep squatting down, man.
You know, I don't know a ton about Relativity as an outfit.
There's a good thing. They had the Motha family, Fat Joe. It's a lot of people coming out of there, but it was more they was really messing with New York artists. We were the only two South artists that they had was 3-6 and Lee. And Squeaking them. So,
well, they did distribute Suave for a hot moment.
For a hot moment, yeah.
So after you, Project Players put out a record.
Yes.
Were you around for that?
Yes.
What was that process like?
That process was a lot easier than mine because we knew what we needed to do. And it was more comfortable because they already had probably 85% of their songs done. I only got on two songs on that album, which was cool. I did the Dirty Down South and the Run 'Em Over, which Dirty Down South had A-Ball and MJG, and Run 'Em Over had M.O.P. out of New York.
Do you feel like a reception was better for their record?
They got better radio play. They definitely got better radio play.
Bucket Naked.
Bucket Naked and Bounce Whip. Bounce.
That was like a Rap City. You know, they kind of got a little love on that.
Oh, yeah.
But then Cram at one point starts flirting with Rap-A-Lot. Is that correct?
Where the whole Project Players went to Rap-A-Lot.
What was that period like for the clip?
You mean for them? Because I wasn't going.
Yeah.
We talked to A-Ball and MJG. They was like, hey, man, no disrespect, but you don't want to go over there and fool with Rap-A-Lot. Rap-A-Lot a different entity. It's like, all right, I'm cool. I'm comfortable where I'm at. I ain't trying to jump ship to ship to ship. No, I'm straight. I I'm loyal. I'm a soldier. I ride with you. Like, man, we're going to go to Rap Line. I'm like, yeah, I know we're balling them, say, right? Yeah, man, they're going to give us $10 million. All right. I'm going to holler at y'all. That's the one time I turned down some money. I knew it wasn't going to work out. I just had a feeling in my gut that it wasn't going to work, and it didn't. In hindsight, it really didn't work out.
What's it like now, seeing all the Orange Mound guys in the different spaces that they are? I mean, each of you have your own individual strengths and weaknesses, and have had a lot of twists and turns in your careers. Just like we were all together on stage. I mean, not all. Squeaky was there. Zerk was there. You were there. We were all representing Memphis Rap OGs. But if you know the story, you know that y'all started out together.
Yeah.
You know, Kareem is doing movies now.
Doing a bunch of them. They call that man Mr. Tubi. So if you watch Tubi, Criminal Man has a lot of movies on Tubi. Neighborhood Dope Man. So on and so forth. I hadn't watched all of them, but which one? Yeah, Memphis-Ghanistan. Like, he got a lot of movies on Tubi. So if you get a chance, go to Tubi and pull him up. You'll see he got a lot of good movies.
Squeaky helped off to become a superstar.
Yes, he did.
And he's got, I'm not going to say where it is, but it's a super secret compound with a lot of gadgets and gadgets, one of the most interesting and amazing studios in town. And you can get a burger and some wings and all other kind of stuff because they got a cook on hand. And, you know, it's a cool place, a cool palace to be in. And Tom Ski is someone that I, you know, it's almost like I can't go to Guitar Center without bumping into you. You buying something, but absolutely, not only yourself, but you're taking care of your artists too. You know, you have such a wide array of young people around you who look up to you, who you help to guide, but they also help to lift you up and your legacy up. And the shows are always electric. And people, I'm not just talking about Memphis people. People are coming from Kentucky. Oh, yeah. People are coming from Georgia. People are coming from all over to connect with you. I'm not just talking about the fans. I'm talking about these artists who really trust you to be a guide for them and a mentor to them. And I remember, I never forget the night that we were all together. I heard, what was it? Big Booty Beatdown. What's it called?
Big Booty Beatdown. Where you at, Pops? That's me hit that boy right there behind. That's his song, Big Booty Beatdown.
Big Booty Beatdown.
I promise you, that song is a anthem, baby.
I ain't forgot about it. It's stuck with me about two, three years.
Yes, sir.
You know, how's it feel that y'all are all in the different spaces that y'all are in? And I mean, to be in your shoes.
It's cool as probably butter on bread, because I get to mentor people that I didn't know I was mentoring. Like, I got two of my artists here now, Mauser, which is in the back, Rory Richie, which right here is in the front. Then me and 3G, this guy right here, we do a lot of Christmas shows. I do a Christmas show every year, and we donate toys to St. Jude. So, like, this is the thing that I get to do that most people don't get to do. I get to help certain artists get to that next level. I get an opportunity to tell them, don't make the mistakes that I did. Make sure you have your paperwork right. Make sure you got your ASCAP or your BMI. Make sure you got your publisher. Make sure you got everything copywritten, because if not, you're going to go through what I went through for 20 years, and you don't want to go through that. It is a hard pill to swallow to see you got $100,000 right there and you can't touch it. That's a terrible thing. But it's lovely, because now they keep me young. As old as I am, they keep me young, because we'll be in the studio, we'll come up with a song, and like Big Booty Beatdown, me and Mauser came over to my house one week. I stayed in North Haven. He was like, man, I got a song. Like, what? Big Booty Beatdown. I'm like, okay. He never could do his second verse. I said, yeah, that wasn't meant for you. So that was meant for me. And we had a blast doing it. We had fun performing it, man. Like, that's probably one of the crunkest songs that we get to do.
Oh. How did you come to the idea to release this record on vinyl, and you did it without relativity being involved, which seems kind of like a magic trick in this day and age. I assume that company is folded at this point.
Oh, relativity?
Yeah.
From what I hear, they're somewhere in Paris.
Okay.
So, you know.
Yeah.
To each his own. I had the company called The Vinyl Spot. They called me up, and they wanted to do a limited edition. I was like, that'd be dope. Like, get 250 records, and if you get it, you get it. If you don't, you don't. You missed out. And they called me. We did all the paperwork and dropped their record, and it was 250. They sent me 50 of them, and they distributed 200. That's why I called you before they got gone.
Yeah, and I'm gonna make sure mine get locked back up in the vault before we leave here tonight.
Yes, sir.
Tom Skimax, we appreciate you. We honor you. We thank you for continuing to lead the way. And for being too wild for the world.
Yes, sir.
All right. Y'all ready to hear some more of the record? We're gonna play it and chill a little bit. So we're going to play some in here. We're going to play some in there. There'll be different parts of the record because it's a long one and we got off track a little bit. So thank y'all for coming. The next one is...
Yeah. You come with the Dowd
Awards. Oh, yeah. The Dowd Awards will be on June 4th at the National Civil Rights Museum. This is an award that I created a few years ago. This is the fourth annual to honor Black creators, music industry people, contemporary and in the past, who, you know, because I'm on the board of the Grammys, I'm on the selection committee for the Memphis Music Hall of Fame. You know, I see also the brass notes and all these other ways that people are celebrated for their longevity and for their hit making ability and for their immediate impact. But I thought there's something more to be said about, you know, the people who not just practice music industry in Memphis, but practice being a Memphian. Practice giving and practice sharing and practice mentoring, practice entrepreneurship, practice leadership in other ways. Because when we look around our schools, our churches, when we look at our small businesses, when we look at in the entrepreneurship sector and technology and all across in this city, like in no other, the people who create the music are also doing other things because they have to, because there's not always going to be an avenue to become a billionaire from this craft. And because there's not always going to be an infrastructure to pick up and because someone else made it say, hey, I want to find another group in Memphis. I want to find another singer in Memphis. So often we have to go away to be able to receive recognition or receive flowers or receive steady work.
That's the sad part. You have to leave to come back.
Absolutely. So for those who have stayed, whether they have created chart topping hits or whether they've not at all, that they've given to community, that they've done those things that make our community better, and they do music. I thought of who could exemplify that, and I looked in history and saw Nat D. Williams, who was the first DJ at WBAA, the first radio station that was dedicated to Black music. And he was a school teacher at Booker T. Washington. He was a journalist at the Memphis World. He was on the radio. He hosted talent shows on Beale Street. He did more than just music business. He did community business. He did the business of Memphis and raising up Memphis. And so we created an award that would honor that legacy. And we use his middle name, the D in Matt D. Williams stands for Dowd. So Thursday, June 4th at the Civil Rights Museum, we'll honor Miss Carla Thomas, Art Gilliam, Taliva Sophia, Errol Randall, Stan Bell, Christy Taylor, Denny Parker, Josephine Bridges, Larry Clark, and Thomas Bingham. And if you don't know all those names, then you can come and find out what they've done beyond music to serve our community. And maybe we'll be having Tom Skimax next time. Musician, mentor, and co-creator of Big Booty Beatdown. Thank y'all. All right, bye, dog. Straight out mobbing through the nation, flipping, bumping on you, hater. Hating on the family, we dedicate.
what I do. Beating you down with a feminist truth. That's why I do what I do, especially when it's towards you. I don't believe you listen to what I heard. Did you understand? That's my word. That's why I'm just too wild for the world.
Straight out mobbing through the nation, flapping, bumping on you haters. Ain't no no family, we dedicated to you traitors. Ain't no way we backing out, so I'll drop this shit your mouth. Some she mad, sprung like girls, but no good to ask the world.
Stay on the block, making papers, that's the way I gotta take. Suckers hating on me and my clique, but we just pop the real from fake. Ain't no way we backing out, so I'll drop this shit your mouth. The family. On the mission was the first. Thompson Masses, now the next. And Project B is coming soon. We gonna rule the industry back. Now the players gonna maintain forever. Hustle in this game. Ain't no hater gonna knock me down to make me fall and lose my fame. It's a trip out life. Those cowards stealing all of these hoes. And that loud, it's so hard you can get me down. Nobody's top of steam. I ain't gonna preach it, but the real ones understand. If it was up to me, the world would be free. Cause I'm the Thompson Masses man. 26 is my life. 98 was really my year for me to come up. On the block, I'm trying to make it on my own. I ain't got no handout, so what about just banging everyone in sight? Then I get caught and go to jail. The prosecutor offer me life. That's a chance if I take, but it's gravy if I make it. Reach a meal and be so big, and you suckers sure to hate me. I'm the one you should knock. Riding the Max so pearly pearl. Remember, talk to your ass.